From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Frank Sinatra once called him the best in the business. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk to the great Tony Bennett about his 40-year singing career. Also today, what's killing off the small towns of America? We talk with Ron Powers, who's written a new book on disappearing small towns. Powers used to work in New York as media critic for CBS Sunday Morning, but he left New York for Vermont. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Terminator 2. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The 35 member countries of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe have issued an urgent appeal to all factions in Yugoslavia to stop fighting. Burton Bolag has more from Prague, where the CSCE is holding an emergency meeting.
The appeal, issued shortly after the beginning of what could be a late-night session here, calls for an immediate and complete cessation of fighting. It says all armed forces in Yugoslavia must return to barracks and, quote, stay there. The appeal appears aimed at both sides in the conflict. In a clear call to the federal government, it says there must be political control over all armed forces. This despite assurances by the Yugoslav delegate here that his country is in complete control of the army. And in a call apparently aimed at the two breakaway republics, the appeal calls for an end to all hostile actions against army barracks. The appeal says the CSCE is ready to send observers. Significantly, the Yugoslav delegate supported that call. For National Public Radio, this is Burton Bolag in Prague.
The interim leadership in Ethiopia has announced a proposed agreement that could permit eventual independence for the province of Eritrea. Eritrea lies along the coastal region of Ethiopia. The new agreement would allow Eritreans to vote on independence in 2 years in exchange for granting access to a vital seaport. It establishes a mutual defense and non-aggression pact between Eritrea and Ethiopia, while assuring that the landlocked portion of Ethiopia will be able to use the Red Sea port of Assab. The plan came after 2 days of debate at a conference among delegates from 25 of Ethiopia's ethnic and political factions. Members of the military wing of Colombia's Medellin drug cartel, who call themselves the Extraditables, said today that they've disbanded their network of terrorists. But the Extraditables insisted that drug trafficking is another matter because of its international scope. Leslie Werpsa reports from Bogota.
The Extraditables said the dissolution of their military apparatus is a result of the decision by the country's Constituent Assembly to prohibit the extradition of Colombian citizens. The Assembly voted to prohibit extradition 2 weeks ago, not long before Medellin cartel chief Pablo Escobar and a group of his cohorts turned themselves in to Colombian authorities. But the new constitution will take effect Thursday at midnight. Critics say years of violent attacks from the so-called extraditables led to the ban on extradition and the government's policy to allow drug traffickers to surrender and confess in exchange for no extradition. But Colombians seem to want an end to violence at any cost. A recent opinion poll showed that over 80% of the Colombian people agree with the government's policy, but the survey found 78% believe that the surrenders would not do much to curb the flow of drugs. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 38 points to close at 2,934.7. Declines led advances by a margin of more than 2-1. This is NPR. Stanford University caused a stir today by proposing an administrative overhead rate for research projects that's almost as high as one that was declared excessive by the federal government earlier this year. The U.S. Office of Management and Budget has been trying to cut down on the amount of federal research money that's skimmed off to pay university administrative costs. OMB is considering a proposal to cap reimbursement of administrative costs at 26%. Stanford announced today that it's proposing an overhead rate of 76% for the next fiscal year. Government auditors have said that Stanford overbilled the government by as much as $200 million during the 1980s. Britain has given approval for the use of the controversial abortion pill RU486. It's only the second country to do so. Jonathan Dyer reports from London.
RU486 is already used in about a third of early abortions in France, where it has a 95% success rate. British health officials said that in the UK, the drug would not be prescribed by family doctors, but only by gynaecologists already licensed to carry out abortions. The new pill will only be an option in the first 9 weeks of pregnancy. The drug takes the form of 3 tablets, followed 48 hours later by an injection. The result is described by the drug's manufacturers, Roussel, as the equivalent of a spontaneous early miscarriage. And they add, it hurts. British anti-abortionists have said that RU486 is the latest evidence of a policy to confuse the reality of abortion. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
Saudi Arabian officials claim today that the huge oil slick spilled into the Persian Gulf during the war over Kuwait has nearly dissipated. It's not clear how much oil spilled into the Gulf, but the latest estimates have put it at around 3.5 million barrels. The allies say that much of that oil was deliberately dumped by the Iraqis occupying Kuwait. A Saudi official said that about 2 million barrels of oil have been cleaned up. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year marks the 40th anniversary of Tony Bennett's first record, and Columbia is using the anniversary as an occasion to bring out a new box set of records that span those 40 years. The anniversary will also be celebrated on a July 4th public television special called A Capital Fourth. Some singers lose their touch as they get older, but Bennett is probably a better singer now than he was in the 50s and 60s when he had all of his hits. His voice might have lost some of its power and range, but the years have brought a depth and beauty of phrasing that would be hard to surpass. One turning point in his career was his 1975 album of duets with Bill Evans. With this sensitive jazz pianist behind Bennett, instead of flashy pop arrangements, you could really hear what Bennett could do with a song.
The night is like a lovely tune. Beware my foolish heart, how white the ever constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart. There's a line between love and fascination. It's hard to see on an evening such as this, for they both give the very same sensation when you're lost in the magic of a kiss.
Tony Bennett's first record was Boulevard of Broken Dreams. You almost wouldn't recognize his voice. It was a semi-operatic performance with lots of big high notes. I asked him if there were opera records around his house when he was growing up.
There really were, because my brother was a magnificent prodigy. He was a very wonderful opera singer. They called him the Little Caruso. He was 13 and sang solo spots in the Metropolitan Opera. And did radio shows in those days. That was the highest ratings. The shows were big. And he was always a guest artist on very big radio shows. And we all loved opera in my home. And it was during the Depression. And, we'd buy these Caruso records and Gigli, and all these magnificent singers, Richard Tucker, and enjoy the way they sang.
So if your brother was the Little Caruso, what were you?
Well, I was the comedian because I had to compete somehow for all that attention. And I imitated Al Jolson and Eddie Cantor and did imitations of them. And it used to break my relatives up every Sunday. They'd make a circle around my sister, my brother, and myself, and we would entertain them. And we couldn't wait for that Sunday. It was so much fun and so much love was given to us and encouragement.
Now, your father died when you were 9. How did your mother raise the money, earn the money to bring up the children?
Well, she was an amazing lady because she was a seamstress, and she worked so hard and raised 3 children. My older sister helped her so much and raised 2 boys and was, we just were very close and very... Well, it was just the most beautiful home life that you could ever dream of. And it was different. It was sad not to have a father and very confusing, but it's funny. It just shows you when people love one another how many things really work out.
How old were you when you had to go out and work for a living?
I was about 15 when I first started. I started out as a singing waiter in the Pheasant Tavern in Astoria, which is now Ricardo's.
So you had to sing in between serving or sing while you were serving?
Well, yeah, both. It was fun. It was almost chaplain-esque, you know, because I had two Irish waiters, and they were great, jolly type guys, and always wanted to encourage me. And I'd get a request to sing "I'll Get By" or a song like that, and I'd run into the kitchen to get. I know if I sang it, I'd get an extra tip, so they'd teach it to me just right on the spot, and I'd come out singing it. And I used to love doing that. You know, it was just so much fun every weekend when I sang there.
Were you still thinking of yourself as the clown when you were performing then?
No, I just enjoyed it. I found out that I've been very fortunate, even before I was known to internationally. I always had luck with audiences. Somehow or other, I always had a gift of communicating, and I got a very nice reaction and encouragement from the audience. So it was always, a positive thing for me to carry on. And I had all kinds of jobs, though. I took all kinds of jobs. I was a runner before computers for the Associated Press. And I'd help the newspapermen get their stories out on the street. And then I was a grocery clerk and an elevator operator, but I really wasn't any good at anything, except I used to have just this craving that I had to become a singer.
Were there any singers in your family? Professional singers?
Well, my brother was a very famous as a young boy. Then he kind of got psyched out by the relatives saying his voice changed at that age, at 15 or 16, and got discouraged about it, unfortunately. But my father, I was told, was a magnificent singer in Italy, that he used to stand his town in Calabria was in a valley, and he used to sing at the top of the mountain, and the whole town would hear him. And they loved the way he sang, the legend goes.
Did you ever think when you started singing that pop wasn't as important or as serious as opera was?
I made believe it was opera was for snobs, but I just adored it. I still do to this day. I mean, I'm thrilled when I hear a great voice like Pavarotti. I mean, I just know exactly what he's doing, and I have a good ear for hearing good opera, and I know right away if someone is singing well or not in opera, and that's the real thing. I mean, those are the real singers in the world, and I adore them. But I always made believe that the entertainment, I put a lot of wit in it, actually, and with what I did, and I just used to just love to sing. I remember very clearly when I was a singing waiter that I said, if nothing ever happens to me, I'd be happy the rest of my life just doing this.
Tony Bennett is my guest, and the 40th anniversary of his first recording will be celebrated on a public television program called A Capital Fourth, to be broadcast, of course, on July 4th. And also, there's a new Columbia box set called 40 Years, The Artistry of Tony Bennett. That's a compilation of records that spans his entire 40-year recording career. You had an uncle, I think, who was in vaudeville. Did your uncle's stories make you want to go into show business? Did it seem like fun to you?
Well, you know, he was a very wise psychologist, as far as I'm concerned, because his name was Dick Gordon, and Dick Sarace, but his stage name was Dick Gordon. And he was really my father, and I didn't know it. I mean, he would just say, after supper, why don't you come and meet me under the lamppost on the street corner? And he would just hang out and talk to me and tell me these legends. And what an influence he was, because he kind of gave me all the rules and what kind of person I should be if I go into show business. And he warned me that, he said, I don't think you're ever going to make it because you have a rasp in your voice. He said, and if you're a singer, you're not going to make it if you sing. And I don't know, he just gave me a fine tuning as to what attitude I should have when I perform and how careful I really have to be about everything.
Well, how did telling you had a rasp in your voice and therefore you'd never make it as a singer help you?
Well, John Barrymore once said, the harder the slap, the greater the artist.
Were you self-conscious about this thing that your father, your uncle had pointed out to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I taught how to... Louis Belson, the great drummer, you know, Pearl Bailey's husband, the late Pearl Bailey, you know, he kind of taught me how to breathe, and so that when I sing, the rasp is not heard at all. And it's just a matter of breathing before you take before a phrase that you sing, you see.
Now, you were in the military in World War II.
I was in the infantry, yes.
Did you sing with a band during that?
After the war, I joined. There was a fantastic story, you know, about Major Lutkoff, who kind of saved me because a racial prejudice situation jumped off, and it was terrible in my life. And it just changed my life, you know, completely and taught me how to behave to my fellow man because... I went to school with a gentleman called Frank Smith, and he was a wonderful friend, black musician. And he and I used to have so much fun together in New York City. And we had a vocal group at the High School of Industrial Art, where I was studying art. And when I was allowed one guest for Thanksgiving and at the Truman Hotel in Mannheim, Germany, after the war was over. And I went to his Baptist church and went to Mass with him, and we had a pleasant time. And I said, "You're allowed to be my guest. Come and have Thanksgiving dinner with me." Well, there was a Southern bigot who was a lieutenant, and he, when I came up out of the restaurant, we were having fun. He came and called me Benedetto. He said, "Come over here," and he took a razor blade and slashed my corporal. Things off my arm and spit on it and threw it on the floor and sent me to graves registration where you dig up bodies. And it was horrible. And Major Letkoff saved me. He heard about the incident and took me away from there right away and made me librarian for a wonderful orchestra that was conducted by Lynn Arison, the warrant officer, and made me the librarian and singer for this beautiful American Forces Network Orchestra.
So as punishment, you were supposed to find the wounded and the dead and bury the dead?
Yes.
How long did you have to do that?
For 2.5 weeks. It was horrible. You know, it's just a horrible thing in my life. And I've never gotten over it. And man's inhumanity in man is very important to me personally.
How do you think you were changed by that experience?
Well, it definitely made me anti-war.
Let's take a short break, and then I'd like to talk with you some more about your singing and about your career. And my guest is Tony Bennett. And this is the 40th anniversary of his recording career, and that's being celebrated in two ways. There's a program called A Capital Fourth on public television on the night of July 4th, and Tony Bennett will be performing as part of that program. And then there's also a new box set on Columbia Records called 40 Years, The Artistry of Tony Bennett. It's a compilation of tracks that span his recording career. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Tony Bennett is my guest. How did you get from the military into performing after the war was over?
Well, I took many auditions because of that wonderful experience of being a librarian with wonderful musicians that all became quite famous, by the way, later on.
What kind of auditions were you going up for, with bands?
Oh, anything. Broadway shows, any job, any kind of job I could possibly get.
And what kind of jobs were you actually getting?
I didn't get any jobs. I was always turned down one audition after another. You know that. Now, a lot of times I thought I did rather well, but it always proved to me that really it's not until you're endorsed by your own peers that things start happening for you.
When you started recording, what was promotion like then? After you had a record out, what were you expected to do to promote the record?
Well, in those days, I started out with a good friend, Rosemary Clooney, and we used to go from town to town, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and get to meet the distributors and the salesmen and the record shops, and we'd go to record shops and sign autographs. And I was the Michael Jackson of my day. You know, we used to have all these teenagers running after me and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Did you have to run for
run
to protect
for my
yourself
life.
Ever? Yeah,
yeah, that was something. There were so many funny incidents.
Tell me one of them.
One day there was this very stern high school principal in a Brooklyn park there, and there were thousands of girls, and she said, "Now, if you girls don't stay quiet and behave, we're not going to have Mr. Bennett sing for you." And as soon as she said that, they rebelled and broke the barriers. All of a sudden, I had to start running, and it was like a Peter Sellers movie. They were coming at me from all directions. They finally got me in one of those little stone houses, and I was trapped like a rat.
What'd they do to you?
Well, they finally pulled everybody away from me. So it was strange.
So you were intact when you were rescued?
Yeah, I was intact.
No, a lot of the jukeboxes in the 50s when you started recording were, I think, controlled by organized crime.
Yeah.
Did you ever have to deal with that with jukeboxes or getting records played on the radio or anything like that? Or did anyone ever try to put any muscle on you in those early days?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's still going on. It's actually much more severe today. It's actually even deeper. It's very, very organized crime today. Everybody that, you know, with each generation, everybody has to do it bigger and better than their parents.
So what was it like when you were getting started? What impact did organized crime have on you? How did you have to deal with it?
Well, I used to say, they'd say to me, "Sing Melancholy Baby," and I'd say, "Well, I don't know that." And they'd say, "Come to me, my melancholy baby."
So this would be in clubs? That would happen?
Yeah, different. Well, not, it wasn't that. It was, you know, everybody had to go through that. In fact, every part of every industry is like that. It's not just the music business. It's every industry.
So, did anyone try to buy a piece of you or anything like that? Did you have to deal with something that...
Oh, yeah,
that
but far? Every artist goes through that. I mean, I read Caruso's life and the same exact thing. I mean, who am I compared to Caruso? I mean, the same thing happened to him. He had to pay... In those days, he had to pay $250,000 to get out of his contract. And that would have been like $2,500,000 right now.
You are really among the most respected singers today, and certainly of your generation. And, I mean, among the things you're respected for is not only the beauty of your voice and the depth of your phrasing, but also your repertoire, your choice of songs, your understanding of what makes a song good. In the 50s and 60s, up until around 1965, you had so many records on the charts. You know, you were recording about 3 albums a year, and a lot of the singles were big hits on the charts. Your last chart hit was in 1965, "If I Ruled the World." And after that, rock and roll really took off, you know, monopolized the charts pretty much. What were those years in the latter part of the 60s like for you? Were you trying very hard to land something else on the charts, or had
no.
you pretty much given up on
no,
that?
I kind of walked away from it. I saw it as a fiasco. It became more and more Madison Avenue programming, you know, just a marketing thing. I've got this wonderful craving. You know, a friend of mine, John Brasha, he's a dancer, and he said to me, "God, you paint every day." He said, "Why don't you stretch out and make it an occupation?" So about 35 years ago, I just took him up on that, and I started painting and going toward selling my paintings and all that and having gallery showings. And then it allowed me to become a performer, because I always had deadlines up until then. I had to do, like you say, 3 albums a year and hit singles and all that, and I was really just into the record business, and I just walked away from it. I personally wasn't rejected. I was the one who decided to take a walk, and what happened was very helpful. I learned that things work out for the best, because what happened is I learned how to perform on stage a lot better. Now that I'm recording, my son Danny was responsible for getting a contract where they trust me, and I just hand in the record. And thank God for him, because it's allowed me the freedom to just express myself freely. And I'm very happy with the recording scene in my personal life right now.
You are a singer who, it seems to me, keeps getting deeper into songs the longer you sing.
Right.
That your phrasing just seems to become, to have more emotional depth all the time.
You know why that happened? I think I have the answer to that. It's so funny. When I used to sit around the house and watch my mom, who just made one dress after another, working on a record-breaking time to sew as many dresses as she can, so that she'd make a little more money for us to live by. And that every once in a while she would stay very calm and very concentrated on what she was doing. But every once in a while she'd get angered, and she would take a dress and throw it over her shoulder, and she'd say, don't have me work on a bad dress. She said, if you give me a good dress, I don't mind doing this. She said, but don't have me ever work on a bad dress, on a cheap dress. And that's why I've just decided never to compromise. I think that's what it came from. I saw that, she was able to sustain because she stayed with good quality. And I asked Sinatra one time, I said, why do you think that we've sustained so long through the years? He said, that's because we stayed with good songs. So I think when you do something of quality, somehow or other, you may not be on top of the charts, but you're always respected and you always have a place in society by doing something that's made very well.
How do you think getting older is changing your voice? And if your voice is changing, how do you think that's changing how you approach a song and how you phrase the lyrics?
Yeah, well, Bobby Hackett taught me to work on bel canto scales every day, and so I've been able to obtain four or five more notes on the bottom of my register. So now I'm a baritone tenor, and I take good care of my voice and myself.
How do you work through a song when you decided to do a new one? Do you have your music director at the piano, and do you work it through with him first?
Well, I try to save him a lot of time, so when I first hear a song, I'll have him put it on tape for me, a little cassette, and then I just learn it that way so that we don't have to go over and over it in the studio. And then when I learn it, then I start doing it in front of an audience and get an audience reaction. Let's see how the audience likes it. And then if they like it and I like it, and I think, I always say to myself, if this is going to become a hit, will I be able to enjoy this song by singing it every night? And that's the test I give it. It's a tough test, but it has to have a very musical structure to it, so that if I have to sing a song every night, it's something that I won't ever mind doing.
I guess some singers are really haunted by their hits. They never really like the song, and now they're forced to sing it one way or another every time they perform.
Right, and that's incorrect. It shouldn't. That's when you pick an inferior song. If you have a good song, you don't mind doing it every night.
Tony Bennett's 40th anniversary in the music business is being celebrated with the release of a new box set of his records. And on the 4th of July, PBS will broadcast a live concert saluting Bennett called A Capital Fourth. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The song is ended, but the melody lingers on. You and the song are gone, but the melody lingers on. The night was splendid and the melody seemed to sing. Summer will pass away.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ron Powers used to spend his weekdays in New York and his weekends in a small town in Connecticut. He found that city dwellers like himself who loved small towns were killing them. Coming up, we talk about the decline of the small town in America with Ron Powers, a former commentator on CBS Sunday Morning and the author of a new book on small towns. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff takes a look at this summer's big movie sequel, Terminator 2, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Yugoslavia, there have been reports of more tanks moving northward from Belgrade toward the breakaway republics of Croatia and Slovenia. The tank column that left Belgrade this morning stopped at the border of Croatia, and no fighting has yet been reported. As NPR's Tom Jelton reports, the army mobilization has raised fears of a massive attack.
The Slovene information minister today said his government has intercepted an army order directing senior officers and soldiers to prepare for new military actions tomorrow. With tanks already massing on the Croatian and Slovenian border, the report is alarming. But the deputy commander of the Yugoslav army in Slovenia, General Andrija Rašeta, pledged today that his forces will not fire unless they are first fired upon. Rašeta said the Yugoslav army is still subservient to the civilian government in Belgrade. Croatian and Slovenian officials are not convinced. The chief of the army's high command last night rejected the government's efforts to negotiate peace with Croatia and Slovenia and said war is now the only way to solve the Yugoslav crisis. Whether the government still controls the army should be soon apparent. A crucial meeting of the eight-man collective Yugoslav presidency is scheduled to be held in Belgrade tomorrow morning. I'm Tom Jelton in Zagreb.
Also in Europe, Britain has banned more than a third of its exports to Yugoslavia. The British Foreign Secretary said unrest there is escalating out of control. German officials have accused the Yugoslav army of being out of control, and officials in Italy have said that they will back the breakaway republics unless a government crackdown ends. Members of the European community have sent three peacekeeping missions to Yugoslavia and have condemned the latest fighting and called again for a ceasefire. Talks aimed at resolving the future of Northern Ireland have collapsed. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The announcement made by Britain's Northern Ireland Secretary, Peter Brook, was not unexpected. The talks had been in trouble for several weeks. The sticking point was the refusal of hardline Protestant leaders to meet face-to-face with representatives of the Irish government in phase two of the talks, scheduled to begin July 16th. Peter Brook met privately with Protestant and Catholic leaders late yesterday to tell them he was winding up the peace talks, which had begun April 30th. Brook said, although the talks had not achieved their goal, they nevertheless had been valuable and produced genuine dialogue. He added that he hoped to explore the possibility of finding terms on which fresh discussions could be held at some time in the future. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 38 points to close at 2,934.71 on volume of some 139 million shares. Pre-holiday trading was light. This is NPR News. In the Soviet Republic of Russia, lawmakers have approved a new law that provides for the sale of state business to individuals and allows workers to buy discounted shares of their factories. The law is very much like one approved earlier this week by national lawmakers, putting state property in the hands of individuals for the first time in 70 years. The Russian measure goes a bit further than the national law by setting a period of 3 years instead of five to sell the property. It also gives a discount to workers seeking to buy into the profits of their own companies. An Israeli soldier was killed today by armed guerrillas during a clash along the usually quiet Israeli-Syrian border. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli soldier was the first Israeli killed on the Syrian border since 1975. Early this morning, armed guerrillas infiltrated across the border and fired missiles and light weapons at a group of Israeli soldiers. One soldier was killed and the others returned fire. The guerrillas fled in the direction of Syria, although it was not clear if they started off in Syria or Lebanon. Recently, there has been a sharp increase in attempts to cross Israel's border with Lebanon, and Israeli soldiers shot and killed five men they said were trying to cross in the past few days. Israeli officials have warned both Syria and Lebanon not to permit attacks on Israel. Some officials say the security situation in the north is deteriorating. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Fighting continues in Lebanon, where troops shelled crowded Palestinian guerrilla camps. There are reports that at least 30 people have been killed and more than 80 others wounded. PLO guerrillas are fighting to hold on to their hilltop positions on the edge of those camps. Hundreds of people, many trying to shield their children, have hidden in alleys of the camps. In trading today in Europe, the dollar was lower. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The quintessential July 4th image is the American small town. But small towns aren't what they used to be. Some are dying because of economic bust. Others are being transformed by economic boom. My guest Ron Powers has written a new book called Far From Home that creates portraits of two small towns, Cairo, Illinois, a victim of depression, and Kent, Connecticut, a victim of development. Powers grew up in a small town in Missouri, where his father was the Fuller Brushman. But Powers left his hometown for a career in journalism. He won a 1973 Pulitzer Prize for his TV criticism at the Chicago Sun-Times. In the 80s, he reached a wider audience as media critic on CBS Sunday Morning. While he was working on that show, he bought a weekend house in Kent, Connecticut, one of the towns he profiles in the book. But he since left his network job, sold the house, and moved to Middlebury, Vermont. I asked him if the deaths of small towns are going unnoticed because we're so preoccupied with decaying cities.
Well, I think it's more a case of the fact that Americans have a fantasy, a necessary fantasy, that small towns are there and they're going to be there when we need them. I think that's a fantasy that is kind of kept alive by commercials and by certain presidential candidates who campaign on grassroots Main Street platforms. And I think Americans need to know that because it is just about the last remaining link we have with this agrarian past of ours. So I think it's more of a sort of a happy wish that when things get too bad and too corrupt and too dangerous and overcrowded in the cities, we can always get in the car and find our hometown. And my message in Far From Home is that that hometown doesn't exist anymore.
Well, one example you use is a place that you lived for weekends for a few years, and that was in Kent, Connecticut. Let me ask you to describe what kind of town this was like at about the time that you moved there in, what, the mid-'80s?
Yes. Kent was and still is, I think, a little sort of pre-revolutionary village with a very strong sense of its own history. Nestled in the foothills of the Berkshires, about 80 miles north of New York City. And because it's not on a superhighway and it requires a couple of dirt roads and at least one covered bridge to get to, it hasn't been overrun, or at least it hadn't been overrun at the time my family and I went out there in the early 80s. But in the mid-'80s, it was Kent's turn. And as we settled into what we thought was going to be a happy life of weekending parents and meeting new neighbors and looking at the landscape and the rivers and the darkness and the fireflies, we realized that we were part of a problem, a migratory wave that was changing the town, colonizing it, and really pushing the native people, the generational people of Kent, back off their native soil.
Now, how did people like you end up pushing out the people who had lived there for generations?
Well, I wasn't a very big part of the problem, Terry, because
confess.
Because I couldn't afford it. I wasn't that rich. I couldn't buy a dairy farm. I could buy a little sort of modified cape house on the edge of town, which was quite lovely for us and very much of a solace to our little boys. But for every house that was bought, exponentially, as the houses got into the farmhouse stage, the property values went up, the property taxes went up. A new family or an old generational family had to find a new place to live that was farther from the town center. And the infrastructure of Kent, the connective tissue, the people who delivered hot meals to old people and sat on the planning commission and that volunteer ambulance people were that much more fragmented. The hardware stores gave way to Chinese takeouts, and we kind of brought the city with us. And pretty soon, the town had become a kind of a cartoon recreation or recreation of an authentic village.
When did the developers start moving into Kent, and how did they get in?
Well, they came in, I think, 1980, 1981, when the stock market sort of jumped up after Reagan's election, and a lot of money-type people had a lot of extra cash at their disposal. There really was a kind of fanning out across New England, maybe other parts of the countries too, not only to find charming villages to spend weekends in, but to speculate in unzoned property often, and to come into a little village where deals were done on a handshake and the trust and the goodwill of the buyer to buy up a lot of land and then suddenly spaghetti strip it for a line of condominiums or of commercial businesses. And that sort of just continued. The shock waves kind of replicated themselves as the years went on. A house that might have been owned by a family for 150 years and perhaps was purchased for $20,000 could easily have been sold by the end of the 80s for a couple of million. And farmers who were cash poor and land rich had very little choice in this matter. With great reluctance, they sold to the developers, and this kind of trend continued.
So if we're looking at Kent as a typical small town that was changed by prosperity, how did the developers change the area? What kinds of buildings exist there that weren't there in the 70s? You mentioned condominiums. Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of condominiums, shopping malls, shopping strips?
There, in the town of Danbury, which I guess if you go back into American history, you might remember a charming phrase called the Danbury Fair. It was kind of a great Connecticut State Fair in the great summers of our tribal history. Horse races, men in straw hats, a great festival of livestock and amusements and things like that. There is now something called the Danbury Fair Shopping Mall. It is a giant octopus with all kinds of tentacles on a great bed of asphalt, one of the largest in New England. And it has sort of, it's been very successful, but it has leached the local storefront owner practically out of existence, not only in Danbury, but in surrounding towns that reach, up to Kent and beyond. So there's that kind of development. There is the sort of mock federal shopping mall that gets put up in a little town like Kent, where the buildings look like a place where George Washington might have slept, but they in fact sell honeydew peanut butter mustard and and tanning salons. And, a mock federal tanning salon is a sight to behold, I guarantee you.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Ron Powers, and his new book is about small towns. It's called Far From Home, Life and Loss in Two American Towns. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about small towns, and my guest is Ron Powers. In 1988, you sold your home in Kent, and you moved to Middlebury, Vermont to become a full-time resident there. It was mm-hmm. no longer a weekend type of thing going back and forth between the city and the country. Why did you want to move out of the city full-time?
The city just wasn't making sense. I mean, I had a job in communications. I was at CBS News. I was working for a program that I admired, Sunday Morning with Charles Kuralt. I liked doing the program. But I suddenly realized, or gradually realized, that in order to do what I liked to do, which was be on television for 4 minutes a week, I was sitting in an office without windows, eating stale bagels from across the street and waiting for the phone to ring. And life was going by, and all of my kind of tribal memories of life in a small town were getting stale. And it just became a real drive, partly to be able to implant in my sons, whose names are Dean and Kevin, who are 9 and 6, and they're terrific kids, a sense of what nighttime is like as opposed to dangerous urban darkness, and a sense of what trees smell like when the seasons change. All those corny things were very important to me. It was a risk. It was a leap that I think a lot of city people are very reluctant to take because we're cutting an umbilical cord. Our livelihoods may not be quite so secure. Once we had implanted ourselves in Middlebury, we never looked back, and we became part of a community that really is trying to not only keep itself going, but look after itself.
When you were living as a weekender in Kent, Connecticut, you weren't able to join volunteer organizations and things like that. Now that you're living full-time in Vermont, are you a member of those volunteer organizations?
Oh, sure. I'm the chairman of the St. Stephen's Episcopal Church Peasant Market, and if you're looking for a bargain in blouses, you might come up and visit us on Saturday. My wife is on the search committee of the parish. We were active in school board activities. There's a wonderful infrastructure for children that we plunge ourselves into. You know, half of the counterculture came up to Vermont in the 1960s, and now they're all 45 years old, but they're still playing their guitars, and they're still drawing, and now they're transferring that kind of expertise to kids. So we don't have the cutting edge, perhaps, of a very hip, sophisticated urban school, but we have the sense of play and craft and that kind of enrichment that we really value. But I don't mean to paint a rosy picture of life in Vermont. The poor people of that state are among the poorest in America. The poverty is hidden by the mountains and the forests and by the obliviousness sometimes of the moneyed newcomers who come there to live in the towns. There is a class system at work that involves perhaps people of French-Canadian stock who are among the dispossessed. The dairy farms are failing, and the only reason, I suppose, Terry, that we don't have a racial crisis is that we never imported a black labor force into Vermont in the 19th century. So I don't mean to say that I'm living in Shangri-La, but I think that, you know, having said that much, I think that Vermont has become an interesting testing ground for a lot of the choices that we're all going to have to face. The scarcity of land, the scarcity of the topsoil, pollution of lakes, what we want to do with the land that we live on. And I think to that extent, Vermont is performing a necessary cutting-edge function in this country's choices.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the planned communities that have gotten started in some areas? And there's a new kind of planned community that's really trying to work on the small town model, but it's being built more or less from scratch.
I guess I have my doubts because planning often comes from a distant place. It comes from a kind of theory about what might work in a region. And I'm very much in the thrall of a wonderful American writer named Wendell Berry, Kentucky hillside farmer and poet and essayist who's been warning us for years now in his writings that we cannot continue to trust the theories of corporations, of university sociologists. We have to know the local region. We have to know the nuances of the place, how it responds to growth, how the seasons change, what the contours of the land are like. I think that planning, sort of like the use of consultants in industry and education and the media and these things, is a kind of pathology. It's a conceit that we can outsmart nature and the land itself. I do believe that we're going to have to get back to local systems of growth and manufacture and consumption if we're going to reverse this kind of mindless centralization that's been happening since the end of World War II.
You were talking to us today from an NPR bureau in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how often you go into the city nowadays, but what's it like for you when you're in Manhattan?
It's amazing how quickly you lose your scar tissue. you lose your resilience against the screamings of deranged people, the dispossessed on the streets, the aggression of traffic, the kind of, not necessarily the fear that people talk about in cities, but almost the anger. I think the thing that comes back into my consciousness when I revisit New York is a kind of provisional anger that you have to have as you walk the streets. I was nearly run down by a car wheeling around a corner into my path as I was getting to the studio today. As I was sitting here waiting for the show to begin, I could hear the screaming of a police siren getting through the soundproofing of this booth. It is very much with us. And I guess what the lesson to me is that it's possible to shed that anxiety and to have a much calmer and kinder understanding of one's fellow man when that fellow man is a person rather than a statistic or, you know, an interchangeable face.
Ron Powers is the author of the new book, Far From Home. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have from Yugoslavia?
Terry, we have reporters on the scene. As you know, Tom Jelton has moved from Belgrade to Zagreb and will have a report. We'll also hear about the U.S. State Department's concerns about what is happening in Yugoslavia and some reaction from the Soviet Union. We have a story from the Financial Times of London about Iraq's chemical weapons equipment. They may have bought much of it in the United States. There are budget difficulties in several states. Some parks are being closed at sunset tonight. And we'll have a tribute today on this day of Wimbledon to Alice Marble.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. At $94 million, Terminator 2 is not only the most expensive sequel in history, it's the most expensive movie ever made. $15 million of that was paid to its star, Arnold Schwarzenegger, largely in the form of a Gulfstream G3 jet plane. And another $5 or $6 million went to the writer-director James Cameron. Film critic Stephen Schiff tells us whether the rest of the money wound up on the screen.
Actually, it did. Terminator 2 is too long, too repetitive, and too self-important, but it does deliver the goods. By which I mean this is a movie in which a lot of explosions get exploded, a lot of car chases get car chased, a lot of gun battles get gun battled. Best of all, well, there's this special effect. It's a watery, malleable, metallic sort of thing that the people at George Lucas's special effects factory have refined and varied until it's positively hypnotic. So much so that director James Cameron can get away with turning it into a major character. T-1000, the new prototype Terminator who can metamorphose into anything, and who's practically unstoppable. More unstoppable, you ask, than the creaky old T-800 Terminator played by Arnold Schwarzenegger? Well, that's what we're here to find out. Both these Terminators, you see, have been sent from the year 2029 into our own age to do battle over a 13-year-old boy named John Connor. They both know that if he's allowed to live, John will grow up to become a great resistance leader, and that after the nuclear war of 1997, he will lead the humans in their battle against the machines, who will by then have taken over the planet. Now, the machines have sent T-1000 to kill young John. The humans, meanwhile, have sent their own reprogrammed T-800, Arnold, to protect him. In fact, even though Arnold is still every inch a Terminator, he's gotten almost cuddly in this movie. The film even toys with making him a father figure for John, whose own father was the gladiator from the future in Terminator 1. Here, in one of John's many lectures on Earth life, he tells his trusty T-800 how much his mom misses his dad.
She still loves him, I guess. I see her crying sometimes. She denies it totally, of course, like she got something stuck in her eye.
Why do you cry?
You mean people?
Yeah.
I don't know. We just cry. You know, when it hurts.
pain causes it?
No. It's different. It's when there's nothing wrong with you, but you're in anyways. You get it?
No.
Obviously, Terminator 2 isn't afraid to get schmaltzy. There's also a voiceover narration that isn't afraid to get pretentious, and a lot of save-the-world moralizing that isn't afraid to get ponderous. But Cameron is smart to build all these seemingly extraneous subtexts into his film. When you're making a movie that's essentially a nonstop battle between soulless machines, you inject humanity wherever you can. Cameron does it by bringing back Linda Hamilton as John's mother, who'll do anything to protect her son, not just out of mother love, but out of a feverish determination to save the world from a future only she can see. Hamilton plays her as a maddened slab of bristling sinew, half commando, half lioness protecting her cub. It's a striking portrait of female heroism, not unlike the one Sigourney Weaver delivered in Cameron's movie Aliens. Still, you don't come to Terminator 2 for the characterizations. You come to see Arnold play an inarticulate expanse of muscle, which of course he does beautifully. But you come for another reason, too. To experience something not so different from the pleasure we receive from spectator sports. You come to see human limitations being surpassed. By robots, yes, but robots who look at least as homo sapien as, say, your average sumo wrestler. And one more thing. In Terminator 2, you'll find confirmation of what many moviegoers have long suspected, that for $94 million, you can make a sequel almost as good as the $6.5 million original.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Ajiva Blytus, and Thad Kirk. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. Have a good holiday.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Tex-Mex with the Texas Tornadoes. We meet the all-star band singer Freddie Fender and organ player Augie Myers. Also, we talk beer with beer expert Michael Jackson. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.